Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Hi there, and thanks a lot for joining me again today. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about coming up, including an update on that new bivalent COVID-19 booster now available in the St. Louis area. We'll talk prostate cancer during this Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, and we'll find out about a new local partnership designed to accelerate life-saving research. But first, let's start the show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchold. Dr. Buchold is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchold, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Always my pleasure, Fred.
So we've got the new COVID bivalent booster out, and it's also coming up on flu shot time. What's your thinking on should we get both at the same time?
Well, that seems to be the recommendations that are coming out of the CDC, and I think there's been efforts to kind of get that in place kind of across the country. So I think the short answer is yes. I can't remember, Fred, if it was last week or the week before, we talked a little bit about kind of the concerns raised about flu maybe being a bit more troublesome this year. You know, so I think definitely getting the flu shot this year is a good piece of business. And, you know, in our clinics, we have it available now. September and October are good times to get your flu shot. And the guidance from the CDC is saying, you know, getting your COVID booster is recommended really before the end of October, before Halloween, basically. So I think out of convenience and to kind of help with uptake, getting them at the same time is kind of what people are recommending, or I should say the CDC is recommending. It seems like it's a logical thing to do. You know, in the past, remember when we were giving out the first couple doses of the COVID vaccine, we were trying not to give it with other vaccines because out of concern or just caution with side effects. I think if you're getting a booster, it you know, there's still probably is going to be a significant portion of the population that will probably feel a little bad after getting the vaccine. That's been that way with flu for a long time. It's been that way with COVID for a long time. But I still think the juice is worth the squeeze, so to speak.
Where do you stand on where you get the shot? One in each arm or both in the same arm?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't care. I the needles don't bother me at all. So, like, if it's convenient and I've got one sleeve rolled up, I might as well get them both in the same arm. But, you know, I think everybody's a little bit dependent. And partly is your past history. If you know you've had a bit of a local reaction or something to it before, to one of those two, it might be worth getting them in separate arms. But I'm a guy that just gets it done. I don't really stress too much about it.
I read a story this past week that if you've been fully vaccinated before you get infected, that reduces your chance of getting long COVID. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and to be clear, Fred, I think just because there's a lot of different things about what full vaccination means is that you got that initial first course of two vaccines. And essentially what it means is basically, you know, it's kind of further evidence that the full vaccination certainly reduces the effects of what COVID does. So you get a milder disease. And this group out of Britain just kind of noted that, you know, probably there's a lesser chance of getting, I'll say, of having symptoms related to what we've kind of called long COVID. I'll give the authors of the study a lot of credit. They're like, well, this is, you know, some of this data is going to naturally be fuzzy because there's really no set criteria for what constitutes long COVID. But there certainly was a difference in the reported of symptoms or the report out of symptoms based on the vaccination. And it certainly kind of adds to this pile of evidence that makes it seem probable that the vaccination, you know, if it doesn't prevent you from getting COVID, it certainly reduces the severity of illness, and it seems like it reduces the odds of having long-term consequences of getting sick. But that's still, I don't think we can say that with full confidence yet, but this, it certainly makes some degree of sense based on the experiences we've been having. And then this is another piece of evidence that adds some confirmation to that hypothesis, so to speak.
We're talking with SLU Care General Internist Dr. Fred Buchholz at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. There's another new study out this week that suggests sitting all day can still cause health problems, even if you exercise. What's going on there?
Well, I think this is another one of these things of just there's more and more evidence kind of making this really to be more of a fact that sitting is bad. And, you know, for somebody that works in the office, say, for 8 hours a day and they're sitting, you know, going to the gym and doing some cardio for 45 minutes before they go sit for 8 hours is the same as somebody doing that cardio and smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. You know, they don't cancel each other out or make things a net, you know, negative or positive. Sitting is just generally not good, particularly for long times. And, you know, going back to, you know, when we were back in the Paleolithic area and we were hunters and gatherers, I mean, our bodies are meant to move around and to be active. We weren't really evolved to sit in a chair for 8 hours at a time staring at a screen. So I think it's really important if you're on that kind of work environment of finding ways to move and keeping moving. And there's actually like basic tricks, Fred. You know, walking up a couple flights of stairs instead of taking an elevator. You know, when I go to stores, I generally park in the back of the lot. It just forces me to walk a little bit longer to get inside the store. It's not that much more, but it just is a way to get things and force yourself to move a little bit more. That being said, there are times where I'm lazy in the hospital, Fred, and I take the elevator up a couple flights of stairs, and I say when I get on the elevator, I'm being lazy. And I think that helps me feel bad and gets me to walking the next time around. But we are designed to be mobile creatures, and I think the more we can do that and fit that in the structure of our day, the better. We are just not designed to sit for a long time, and the health consequences of that are becoming more and more clear. It's equivalent to like smoking or any other kind of really unhealthy habit that we've talked a lot about on the show the last couple of years.
You know, I go for a couple walks a day with my dog. Actually, it's more of a slow stroll. But there are certain neighbors that I see, a couple of them, that are constantly walking morning and evening. Is there a limit to how much you could walk? Does it suddenly at some point hit a point where you don't need to walk that much?
Well, my short answer to that is no. I any kind of activity is good. I think the big thing is just like with everything I think I've said and what I'll consistently say is everything in moderation is probably best. So, you know, with extreme activity you run the risk of, you know, either overuse injuries or any other kind of injury from kind of excess. So like if you're walking and your muscles are starting to ache and you're getting tired, say for instance, you're walking and your quadriceps, which is the muscle in the front part of your thighs, starts to fatigue. Well, the quadriceps is really related to the stability of your knee. And so if you're walking and you're not able to keep good stability of your knee and the muscle is fatigued, that's where you run the risk of injury. So at that point, when you start to feel that ache and fatigue or tiredness, taking a rest is, you know, in my mind, some good business and letting the muscle recover. So that same logic applies with everything. But, you know, walking is certainly, you know, gentler on the joints than running. And it's a good piece of exercise, particularly if you get yourself a little winded, you know. So when I go for my wife and I have been in the habit of going for long walks in the morning on these really nice days we've been having, you know, we're looking for hills. We're looking to kind of, you know, we're not sprinting up the hill by any stretch of imagination, but you're moving at a decent pace so that we feel a little breathless. And I think that is probably a better use of your walk than just kind of a gentle stroll. But I'm with you. I go with my dogs, and then they have to smell every single yard that we go to. It's really annoying.
So is there any benefit to going beyond 10,000 steps a day?
No, absolutely. And again, your fitness and your that fatigue element is probably the big part of that. You know, and I think it's not so much the number of the steps, and you know, there's conflicting data about this, certainly, but it's not necessarily the number of steps, but it's also, you know, the degree of how much your heart rate goes up, you know, whether or not you get a little short of breath. You know, so I think you could do less steps but have some more of that kind of exertion and probably have a decent benefit as well. If you're using a step counter, you're just kind of counting because you're up and about throughout the day, you know, either at your work or with your leisure activities, you know, hitting that 10,000 probably is a good marker of whether or not you've done a sufficient amount that day. But I guess 10,000 steps, just kind of doing the things you do normally versus, say, 3,000 steps, and you're going at that at a pretty decent clip and at a kind of a brisk pace, you know, probably one is better than the other. I would say the latter is better than the former, but you know, both are fine.
Hey, Dr. Buchholz, thanks so much for your time again this week. Really do appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure, Fred. Thanks.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll get an update on that new bivalent COVID-19 booster. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
The St. Louis County Department of Public Health is administering the new bivalent COVID booster. KMOX's Maria Kina talked with County Health Department spokesman Christopher Ave about who should get the new booster and what is on the radar for health experts this fall regarding COVID and the flu season.
We are excited to be able to offer the new booster shot for COVID that has been optimized to fight the Omicron variants 4 and 5. This is important because these variants are the most common kind of COVID in our community, and they're also the most easily transmissible kind of COVID. That means that they're pesky and they get inside of us. And it's important that we use all the tools at our disposal to protect ourselves and our communities against COVID-19. So the new booster is absolutely recommended for people who have already gotten at least their initial COVID vaccine. So if you haven't gotten that first vaccine, please don't ask for the booster. Come on in and get that vaccine taken care of. Most of those that we give are 2-dose regimens. So you'll want to get that done first. But if you've had that, and if it's been at least 2 months since you've had a COVID shot, why then you are eligible for the new booster as long as you are 12 or older. The CDC has not approved the new boosters for younger than 12, but we expect that they will extend that in the coming days and weeks. So sit tight. If you are a youngster, you certainly can get the old booster. If you are a young person or you have children, you want them to get boosted, they can get a booster. They just can't get the new booster.
Christopher, talk about what you expect to see in the fall, where your cases stand right now, and if you expect to see them increase.
Yeah, we're still in a period of high transmission. We are experiencing in St. Louis County alone more than 200 new cases of COVID every day. And that's only the number of cases that we know about. There are a lot of people who are testing positive at home using those antigen test kits. And those people, by and large, don't report their results. They're not required to. So there's more COVID in the community than we even know about. And that's a little scary heading into the fall. Why? Because in the fall, as the temperatures drop, cases rise. People tend to spend more time indoors in groups. And we know that COVID is transmitted indoors in groups of people more easily than in other situations. So we are afraid that we may get another boost, another burst of COVID cases in the fall and winter. We hope that's not the case. It makes it even more important, Maria, for everyone who is eligible to get this new booster shot, which protects against the most transmissible versions of COVID.
When I'm out, I don't see very many people wearing masks. What's your recommendation? I realize there are no mandates. There's nothing in place to require people to wear masks. But what's your recommendation as we head certainly into the colder months?
Masks are proven by science to reduce transmission of COVID. Don't believe anyone who tells you anything differently. Masks are effective. And even though they may not be popular right now, and we're probably all a bit sick of wearing masks, they really are a proven and tested strategy, a tool that we have to fight against transmission of COVID. So when you're in groups of people, especially indoors, still a good idea to wear a mask.
Christopher, experts are expecting a rough flu season, something we didn't see during the height of the pandemic. Talk to me about what people should do as far as getting the flu vaccine and these booster shots.
Well, we absolutely encourage people to get vaccinated against the flu. It is certainly safe and encouraged to get the flu vaccine and the COVID booster at the same time, if that's what you want to do. That's not a problem. At the moment, the St. Louis County Department of Public Health clinics do not yet have all of our flu vaccine doses in yet. So we're not quite ready to give the flu shot, but there are plenty of places where you can get the flu shot. You go to your local pharmacy or clinic or doctor's office. We absolutely encourage everyone to get a flu shot every year. I don't know if you've ever had the flu. Maria, I unfortunately had it a few years ago, and it kicked me in the butt and put me down for the count. I ended up getting even pneumonia from that. So really, you don't want that to happen. You absolutely want to get the flu shot. I hope it's not a bad season. I hope those experts you're hearing from are wrong. The last thing I would say is that some of the same tactics that you can take to avoid getting COVID also apply to the flu. That is to say, if you use good hygiene and you wear your masks when you're in crowds, especially indoors, that helps prevent you from getting the flu. So those are still good, safe, solid, scientifically backed practices.
What's your advice to people as we head into the winter months here for people who are boosted, even with the new vaccine?
Well, it's important to remember that any COVID shot or booster is not I can do anything I want without risk card. We need to use all the tools available to us. And some of those tools include being careful about where we go and the situations we put ourselves in. COVID, we know, is an airborne virus that is transmitted most easily when people congregate indoors. So if you are facing situations with big crowds of people and you're indoors, it just makes sense to wear a mask. It also makes sense to improve the ventilation in your home or office. These are things that we can all do, even if it means opening a window and turning on the AC or the heater. These are things that we all can do to reduce the chances of transmission. Absolutely, though, take advantage of this new booster shot. It's optimized against the most pernicious forms of the virus that causes COVID-19. This is what you want to get.
St. Louis County Health Department's Christopher Abe, thank you for being with us today on Health Matters.
KMOX's Maria Kina. Let's take a moment now to talk about your brain health and multivitamins. A new study from the Alzheimer's Association suggests taking a daily multivitamin may slow cognitive decline in older adults. CNN medical contributor Dr. Tara Narula talked about that with Jake Tapper.
Yes, so this was a study of 2,200 older Americans, so over 65, average age about 72. And researchers wanted to see if they gave them a supplement, either a cocoa extract supplement or a multivitamin, could they protect their cognitive function? So they gave them a cognitive test at baseline, and then after 3 years, they would test them year one, two, and three. And essentially, they thought they might find a benefit with the cocoa extract group, but they did not. What they did find was a significant benefit in the multivitamin group. They found that it basically slowed the decline of cognitive aging by about 60%. In addition to that, in those patients or subjects that had underlying cardiovascular disease, they saw even more benefit.
So people seem really excited about this. Other than the obvious reasons, why do you think it's so interesting?
Well, prior reviews of nutritional supplements have really shown insufficient evidence to recommend that to protect cognitive function. So this is kind of the first large-scale, what we call randomized controlled trial, of high-quality study to show a potential benefit. There's no FDA-approved interventions for older asymptomatic adults to protect cognitive function. So when you think of the potential public health impact of something as simple as a multivitamin that's safe, accessible, affordable, if it really is effective, you could have the potential to help millions of Americans. We know that 6.5 million of Americans have Alzheimer's disease. When you look worldwide, we're talking about 46 million adults who suffer from Alzheimer's dementia or some form of dementia. So real potential.
So what are the takeaways? Like, what should people at home be doing right now because they're watching us?
Well, it's important to emphasize this is not practice or guideline changing yet. This is definitely preliminary.
Just one study.
One study, important to replicate it in larger studies with a more diverse population. And what we really counsel people for in general is to eat a well-balanced diet, right? There's tons of bioactive nutrients in a good diet, and you can get them that way. There are certain populations that certainly need supplementation. And then there are other low-cost strategies that you can do to improve your cognitive function, things like exercise, things like managing your stress, sleep, avoiding too much alcohol or cigarettes, social stimulation, mental stimulation. So these are easy strategies to use.
And I have heard in the past people in the medical community express concern about supplements.
I'm so glad you asked this question because this comes up all the time. And many times patients don't actually tell you they're taking supplements. So it's really important for healthcare providers to ask that question, are you taking supplements, and to review with patients what they're taking. The supplement industry is not regulated by the FDA as drugs. They're regulated as foods. So essentially they get put out on the market without having to prove safety. The labels may not always be accurate. And so there have been many cases of supplements having contaminants in them, heavy metals, other chemicals, other types of drugs. Sometimes they can interact with prescription meds that you're taking, and people have ended up in the emergency room or hospitalized because of supplement use. Now, multivitamins in general are probably relatively safe, but even those, it's important to discuss with your primary care doctor or your doctor, this is what I'm taking, is it okay? Because in some patient populations who have underlying conditions or are taking other drugs, it may not be okay.
CNN's Jake Tapper talking with medical contributor Dr. Tara Narula. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll get the latest on prostate cancer. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. William Dayhut. Dr. Dayhut is the Chief Scientific Officer for the American Cancer Society. Dr. Dayhut, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
So how common is prostate cancer?
Prostate cancer is very common. In fact, in 2022, we expect 270,000 new prostate cancer diagnoses and about 34,000 prostate cancer deaths. So it's actually the most common non-skin cancer for men.
Who is most at risk?
Well, all males are at risk, but the population that's at greatest risk are the black male. In fact, interestingly enough, there is a 68% higher risk of prostate cancer diagnosis, but almost 100% or twice as many black men will actually die of the disease than white men in the same population. And in Missouri, to give you some numbers, for example, out of 100,000 men, 17 white men are likely to die from the disease, but nearly 37 black men would die from the disease in Missouri.
Why the racial disparity?
Well, it's probably a couple things. One, we think it's probably is biology, because we actually, if we look at African males on the continent of Africa, there is a high risk of prostate cancer. We also think that screening and detection is probably part of the reason. We know that black males are much less likely to be diagnosed with early stage disease. In other words, when they're diagnosed, they have more advanced disease than white males. And we know that if you're diagnosed with early stage disease, you have a much better outcome. In fact, people with advanced disease only account for about 10% of all the diagnoses, but about 30% of the deaths. It's different than breast cancer. In breast cancer, we see a greater number of women, white women, actually diagnosed with the disease, but a greater number of black women dying from the disease. In prostate cancer, it's a higher number of black men diagnosed with the disease and also a higher number of black men dying from the disease. So it's probably biology and probably also a detection screening component too.
So what are some measures to reverse that?
Well, lots of research is ongoing to see whether or not there are changes that can be done as far as treatments and diagnosis. And we do know there are certain factors that may have an impact. And if we look at environmental risk factors, such as diet in certain populations, if we look at Asian men who move to this country, within one generation, their risk of prostate cancer goes up significantly. So there could be some factors of healthy eating which could impact prostate cancer. But detecting prostate cancer early is still probably the best way to treat and fight it. And detection can be done when tipped off by a simple blood test. A test called the PSA test, or prostate-specific antigen test, can give your physician a clue whether or not you have prostate cancer. It's not a diagnostic test. But if your level is elevated, that may then lead to more testing, such as an MRI and potentially a biopsy. So finding it earlier is really still the best way to treat it.
We're talking with Dr. William Dayhut. Dr. Dayhut is the Chief Scientific Officer for the American Cancer Society. Let's talk about screenings. What are the current guidelines?
Well, currently, the American Cancer Society recommends if you're a black man at age 45, you should begin talking to your physician about getting a PSA test. And then if you're a white male, probably around age 50. I think people should also take into account other factors which may increase their risk if you have a strong family history. If you have some inherited genetic factors, for example, if you have the breast cancer gene in your family, BRCA2, and you're obviously a carrier of it, you probably should do screening earlier because your risk is 5 times what the population would be at large. So we're currently redoing our guidelines, updating them with new information, which I hope we'll have available within the next 6 to 12 months, because we do think there should be some personalized guidelines for patients, as well as having them adaptable over time as more information becomes available.
If prostate cancer is detected through this screening, what happens then?
So what happens first is you have a blood test, which would give you a clue whether or not you have prostate cancer. At that point, men are generally referred for either an MRI to see if they see an area on the prostate or an ultrasound with a biopsy. MRIs don't detect all the cancer on the prostate, but they give an indication of where the areas are that the more aggressive prostate cancer could be. If a man has a biopsy and if a prostate cancer is detected, then the pathologist looks under the microscope and gives a prostate cancer grade. And at that point, a discussion is made about whether treatment should be done now or treatment should be deferred until the cancer has become more aggressive. So it's important to know that simply having a prostate cancer diagnosis does not mean that treatment needs to be done urgently. It may mean that patients can be followed over time safely, and if the cancer starts to grow, then treatment is indicated. There are some prostate cancers that can be followed safely with PSA tests, biopsies, and MRIs, and then over time, a decision can be made if treatment is needed. And so I think that's important for men to know, that men are often fearful about having a diagnosis because the treatments do have side effects. The most common treatments are either the removal of the prostate, or radiation to the prostate. And sometimes that also includes drugs that block testosterone and hormonal therapy treatment. So men are often fearful of having treatments, which could have an impact on both their urinary function as well as their sexual function. But sometimes when it's detected early, it can be in a place where it's safe to follow it over time. And so that's why not simply putting your head in the sand and just hoping things will be okay is what's most important.
Dr. Dehat, once again, what's the main message you want men to take from this interview?
The main message is that people should talk to physicians about being screened. I think finding prostate cancer earlier will allow for better outcomes and better options for patients.
Dr. Dehat, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Dr. William Dehat is the Chief Scientific Officer for the American Cancer Society. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll find out about a new local partnership designed to accelerate life-saving research. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
Washington University School of Medicine and BJC Healthcare are joining forces and partnering with CuraMeta, a new company that will accelerate life-saving research in the fight against chronic and acute diseases that impact our communities. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Philip Payne. Dr. Payne is the director of the Institute for Informatics at WashU School of Medicine. Dr. Payne, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you. I'm very happy to be here today.
So tell us about this partnership.
Well, this partnership came out of a couple of years of very intense work where we realized there was an opportunity to harness our data and informatics assets and accelerate research, but that we needed to be more strategic in terms of how we partnered with life science and biotechnology companies in order to do so. And the result is the formation of CuraMeta, which will really help us to make the connections with these partners, to prioritize projects, to manage the exchange of data in a secure and privacy-conserving manner, and then ultimately get these new diagnostics and therapeutics back to our patients more quickly.
What exactly is informatics?
Right. A question I get asked quite a bit. So informatics is really the study of how we take the raw data that's produced everywhere in our health system, whether that be in our labs or in our clinics or at the population level, and turn that into actionable knowledge so we can actually do something with it. A great example would be taking all the data that we may have in an electronic health record, de-identifying it, and then using modern artificial intelligence techniques to find out if there are new uses for existing drugs so that we can better treat a given disease.
And what exactly is this new company called CuraMeta?
Right. So CuraMeta is a new company. It's headquartered here in St. Louis. And it is going to build up a team that will go out and identify life science and biotech organizations that want to engage in what we call real-world data or evidence research. And that's where, instead of highly controlled clinical trials, we actually use what we sometimes refer to as the data exhaust of all of our healthcare activities, the data that's produced every day, and examine that data to find out if a new treatment is viable, if there are new uses for existing drugs, if there are trends in a particular disease that may indicate the need for novel diagnostics or therapeutics, and lots of other variations on that theme. And so CuraMeta will really help to bring those partners together with Washington University and BJC Healthcare to pursue that type of real-world data research.
Is CuraMeta a standalone company, and where in St. Louis is it?
Yes. So CuraMeta is a standalone company. We, Washington University, as well as BJC Healthcare, are investors in the company, but there are a number of other investors, and it's based right here in St. Louis in the Cortex Innovation District.
How cutting edge is this?
So in a lot of ways, we see this as the next step in the evolution of medicine to become really digitally enabled. So the first step was digitizing medical records and other sources of data. And we've been doing that for a number of decades now. And there's been a tremendous investment on the order of billions and billions of dollars nationally to do that. Now we have more data than we've ever had before, but we only use a tiny fraction of that. And so companies like Curameta will help us move to the next stage in the digitization of medicine, where we'll harness that data, again, in a secure and privacy-conserving manner so that we can accelerate research and find new diagnostics and therapeutics. And traditionally, that sort of research has taken decades and cost on the order of billions of dollars for just a single new medication. And with this type of real-world evidence generating research that we are envisioning, we can take that down to a few months or years and perhaps a few million dollars. So the order of magnitude change and the impact on our patients and communities is massive.
We're talking with Dr. Philip Payne. Dr. Payne is director of the Institute for Informatics at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Payne, give us some examples of how the average patient will benefit or even notice this change.
So our patients today, when they seek care, are given very explicit notifications about how we will use data for research and how we protect their privacy when we do so. And so even today, we are using small amounts of data produced in our clinical operations with appropriate privacy-conserving measures to identify important trends in terms of both wellness and disease. What our patients will notice is that this new venture will allow us to conduct even larger scale research, which will have the impact of bringing back new treatments and new diagnostic tools more quickly. So whether you have cardiovascular disease or endocrine disease or a neurodegenerative condition or cancer, you will see the opportunity through WashU and BJC to participate in more studies of these new approaches to both preventing and then treating disease. So our hope is the biggest difference that our patients will see is that we are using this as a catalyst to make sure that we are learning every single time we interact with the patient and improving the care that they receive or that their family members receive or that their community receives. And we think we have an ethical and moral commitment to do exactly that as a research-intensive, academically-based health system.
You mentioned several diseases. Is there a focus on any certain disease?
So in the early stages of Curameta, we're certainly focusing on a number of diseases where we have large numbers of patients who are impacted by those conditions and where there's a lot of interest in the life science and biotech sectors in the development of new diagnostics and therapeutics. And they include a number of different cancers, neurodegeneration, and cardiovascular disease, to name a few of many. And we'll be starting with some of those high-priority diseases as we begin to scale up Curameta and the partnerships that it brings to the health system and to the university.
How exciting is this?
We're extremely excited. I think in many ways, this is the realization of our vision for building a learning healthcare system where we are not only taking care of our patients with the best available evidence that we have today, but we're also learning and improving that care and making sure that the research that's being conducted here at Washington University and at BJC Healthcare has direct impact on the communities that we serve. And that's really the core business that we're in, continuous improvement and serving the communities around us and using our research capabilities to make that possible. And Curameta really will accelerate all of those activities in a very positive way. And because of that, we're extremely excited about this development.
How long until you start seeing some results?
So we anticipate by the end of this calendar year that we'll start to see partnerships with life science and biotech companies as a result of Curameta's activities. And so therefore, we should have new studies and new evidence and potentially new diagnostics and therapeutics in an order of just 12 to perhaps 24 months. And when you compare that to traditional timescales for research, that is a many-fold improvement in the speed and efficiency of these types of investigative activities.
Dr. Payne, what's the main message you want listeners to get out of this?
I think the main message we want listeners to hear as a result of this development is that we as a health system and a university are committed to continuous improvement and to making sure that we serve the needs of our communities. And one of the ways that we do that is by taking the best possible science and using that science to inform how we care for individuals, their families, and the broader population here in the St. Louis region. And Curameta is a way for us to accelerate all of those activities and do so in a way that meets the needs of our communities. I think a secondary benefit of this effort is that this is a company that will really serve as a foundation for many other digital healthcare startups that we hope to see forming here in the St. Louis region. And many people aren't aware, but St. Louis has a higher amount of healthcare expenditures than many other cities that are seen as leaders in the healthcare field, such as Cleveland or Boston. And this is an opportunity for us to leverage that to create economic growth and regional impact as well. So really a dual benefit, improving the care we deliver and having meaningful economic impact for the region.
Dr. Payne, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Philip Payne is the chief data scientist and director of the Institute for Informatics at Washington University School of Medicine. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the Odyssey app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join me again next week for another edition of Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.